Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up on today's broadcast, Saint Anselm. Of Aosta, of Canterbury, or of Bec? Meet you tonight in the courtyard of the Vatican Museums. And our weekly rendezvous with our popular Latin lover. First of all, why not join Pope Benedict XVI, who's almost completed his second week of holidaying in the Italian Alps, for whom, despite an unfortunate fall last week, which provoked a fractured wrist, plans have remained unchanged. Naturally, all except his physical impediment to writing with his right hand. A disappointment for the Holy Father, who, as we know, had in mind, as he always does, on holiday, to spend some of the day in writing. At any rate, the more official moments on his agenda were respected. And so on Friday, plans to travel downhill from the village of Le Combe, where he's currently staying, to the city of Aosta went ahead. Taking the route, this time not of Aosta Hospital, where they set his hand last week, but of Aosta Cathedral, where celebrations to mark 9 centuries since the death of Saint Anselm are underway. Saint Anselm, the Benedictine monk, who was bishop of Aosta between 994 and 1025. Earlier in the year, on this saint's feast day, which falls on the 21st of April, Pope Benedict had sent a special message of encouragement to the inhabitants of this valley caught between steep mountains to look with admiration to their fellow citizen, who to this day shines like a beacon of light for the entire church. To this great monk, theologian and pastor of souls, whose work has left a deep sign in the history of the church. This anniversary, the Pope went on to say on that occasion, provides us with an opportunity to renew the memory of one of the most radiant figures, both within the tradition of the Church and of history of Western European thought. Let's recall for a moment how a century ago the Pope of the time, Pius X, published an encyclical focusing on the figure of Saint Anselm by the title of Communium Rerum, describing this doctor of the Church, Anselm of Aosta, as a most vigorous exponent of Catholic truth and defender of the rights of the Church, first as monk and abbot in France, and later as Archbishop of Canterbury and primate in England. In an effort to find out more about Saint Anselm, I turned to a fellow Benedictine, Dom Henry O'Shea, Secretary General to the Abbot Primate of the Benedictine Confederation, not Kavolf, and who therefore lives at the College of St. Anselm High on Rome's Aventine Hill, but who's originally from the monastery of Glenstall Abbey in Ireland, and who was also kind enough to come to the radio and sit down with me in our studios here. Let's listen to our conversation. Henry O'Shea, you just told me that by training you were a historian.
Yes.
I can ask you the first question. I'm a little confused. St. Anselm was a Benedictine monk.
Yes.
Considered to be an Italian.
Yes.
Monk, medieval philosopher and theologian who was born in Aosta, which then was within the boundaries of the Kingdom of Burgundy.
Burgundy.
Yeah, I think he's best known to the English-speaking world as St. Anselm of Canterbury. There's a bit of a leap there from Ulster to Canterbury. What did he do? Go hopping around all the various monasteries in Europe?
Yes. Well, I think the first thing we've got to be aware of is that modern boundaries, of course, are relatively recent. The Burgundy you're talking about was much bigger than the Burgundy that we would know today.
It was
a kingdom. In its own right, and very important, in fact. One of the main titles, for example, of the Habsburgs later on was actually Duke of Burgundy. And it still features in the coats of arms, if you're interested in those things. But the important thing is that you're talking about somebody who, while being very careful not to transfer modern categories of European, etc., etc., at the same time, it is true that at that stage there was a fairly cosmopolitan society. That's the first thing. The second thing, of course, about Anselm is that one of the main reasons he left home was because of an unsatisfactory relationship with his father.
He came from an aristocratic family.
His father clearly wasn't terribly keen on his joining the monastery, which he wanted to do at the age of 15. So he went then to Normandy. Now, I suppose, again, transferring modern ideas to those days, this was one of the places where careers were being made at the time. They were themselves, Normandy, as the name would suggest, were themselves, as it were, two or three centuries on from their own invasion, and we're now talking about the time running up to the Norman invasion of England.
Anselm was born in 1033.
1033, exactly. So 30 years before.
30 years before 1066.
And all that, yes. And so I think, of course, the main attraction seems to have been that Lanfranc, who also came from that part of Burgundy, was the prior of Bec at the time, a monastery which in recent times has come to exist again. And it was also, I think, if we're to believe what we're told by the various lives of Anselm, etc., he was also attracted by the intellectual status of Lanfranc. It's normal today to think of Benedictines as learned. That, in fact, really comes from a development in the 17th century rather than before that. But nevertheless, it's true in this case that Bec was the centre of learning, particularly was the centre of what we might call the revival of learning after the so-called Dark Ages, which were never as dark as we were led to believe. But nevertheless,
the time of St. Bede and the Venerable
Well, that was slightly earlier, yes, of course. And Anselm, I suppose, if he was thinking historically, though we don't know whether he did or not.
He wrote about Bede, didn't he?
Yes, he did. And he would probably have seen himself then in that tradition of monastic learning, which is why, of course, he's so interesting for many Benedictines today as well. It's very interesting for me, coming as I do from Ireland. I don't normally think of St. Anselm primarily as St. Anselm of Canterbury at all. I think of him primarily as Anselm of Bec, not of Aosta, not of Canterbury, but of Bec. Because for us, if you were to take Anselm as a model, one of the most interesting things for us is his time as prior of Bec, where he really started what was in effect, though not a name, a university. It's probably better to use the German word Hochschule.
Which means?
Centre of learning, high school, basically, really.
You mentioned his appeal to you today as a monk, I imagine, as
yes.
a Benedictine monk,
yes.
as Dom Henry. But what is his appeal, do you think, to the rest of the world, the Catholic world, the Anglicans and the Lutherans as well?
I think probably the most important thing is the combination of genuine sanctity with intellectual rigour and curiosity. Because for many people, there's a great tendency, not just today, but in previous centuries as well, to imagine that to embrace the religious life is also to embrace a certain form of brain death. And that is not at all true. And the great attraction of Anselm is that he combines a very, very strong faith with strong sense of intellectual inquiry and also a strong sense of intellectual rigour. He wrote, of course, highly interesting things, and the questions he talked about both in theology and in philosophy are absolutely fascinating for us today. It doesn't necessarily mean that we automatically agree with everything he said, because in many ways the debate has moved on, as it were. But the very fact that the debate itself should have taken place at all is fascinating. And the issues he discussed are still issues for today. The existence of God, the role of individual faith, the appropriation of the teaching of the Church, the appropriation of the teaching of the Bible, etc. Those are all as acute issues today as they were 1,000 years ago.
His symbol in hagiography, however you pronounce that word, is the ship.
Yes.
It represents the spiritual independence of the Church, no?
Not just that. I'm very interested in heraldry. Though interestingly, his coat of arms is not the ship, but it's used as his attribute as a saint. What it really is the idea of set out into the deep. Set out into the deep for various things. Set out into the deep as a pastor, as a fisherman, but also set out into the deep of the possible dangers of exploration and inquiry. That's also terribly important. So it's a very happy symbol, which I would have no difficulty in identifying.
Yet he was caught between being a contemplative monk and a savvy politician, in a sense, wasn't he?
Of course, but that was inevitable in those times, given the political, we use the word now, position of the Archbishop of Canterbury, or even an Abbot of Bec. Because remember, of course, that these people were also important feudal lords. And as feudal lords, of course, that was the origin of the dispute then between the Pope and the Emperor, between the King and the Archbishop, about the precise role of both. The King as the temporal lord who depended on the support of his feudal lords in battle, for example, an Archbishop had to provide the service of so many knights, etc., etc., or if he couldn't do that, he had to provide money. So inevitably, an Archbishop, a prelate of any kind, of any importance, would be caught up in the political circumstances of the day. And of course, remember, at this time you're also dealing in the period immediately during and after the Gregorian reforms. This whole question, this reassertion of the, or probably assertion is a better word than reassertion, of the temporal as well as the spiritual power of the papacy and the Church generally. What you were really at a period where we're working out what in subsequent centuries was to become the current models both of the political society and of the ecclesiastical society. We tend, of course, today to make this absolute distinction between church and state. That's a relatively modern development, of which this, of course, is the beginning. There are other civilizations and other cultures that just don't have that concept, even today.
Even the fact of St. Anselm writing to people like kings and queens, like Matilda of England, that gives you the sense of the role of the Church in society. It transpires in Pius X's encyclical Communium Rerum, which was published, well, exactly 100 years to mark eight centuries since Anselm's death. It seems incredible that a pope would write an encyclical on a figure like Anselm today. I mean, you wouldn't think of Benedict today writing an encyclical on St. Anselm, would you?
Probably not an encyclical, but he certainly wrote a letter recently, because he's a very important person for the present Holy Father, precisely because he emphasised, St. Anselm, that is, emphasised the importance of reason, the importance of intelligence, the importance of intelligent inquiry, the possibility of uniting that with faith. The important thing, of course, for Anselm, as it is also for the present Holy Fathers, we start off in a context of faith. And all our theologizing, all our philosophizing is done in that context of faith. It doesn't mean, of course, that we don't apply the necessarily rigorous intellectual standards. Of course, we have to do that. But it's not at all unusual. And also, of course, I don't know how encyclicals come to be, but certainly at the time the Benedictines were in the course of a great revival at the beginning of the 20th century, and Pius X was a great supporter of, for example, the College of Sant'Anselmo in Rome, which was not called Sant'Anselmo just for nothing. It was also, of course, because we were Benedictines, Anselm was a Benedictine, but also because the College of Sant'Anselmo had already been established in the 17th century, St. Anselm being the great model theologian, intellectual saint, etc. The title was transferred then at the end of the 19th century to this new Benedictine confederation, which had been set up by Pope Leo XIII. To try to unify the Benedictines, he wasn't totally successful in that, but what he was very successful in was establishing the College of Sant'Anselmo as a centre of theology, philosophy, intellectual inquiry and training for Benedictines. And I think they may have had something to do in encouraging Pope Pius X to write his encyclical, because, of course, he talks about all of that, the importance of faith, reason.
What do you think is the Benedictine hallmark of St. Anselm, at a personal level?
Well, for us, certainly his approach to the scriptures, for example, that's still very much in the monastic, what we now regard as the monastic tradition. There's been a huge amount of work done, particularly in the last 100 years, on the monastic use of the scriptures as a source of theology. It is also true that Anselm has already started to move from a purely scripture-based theology to, he's called, for example, the first of the scholastics. Now, I don't know how accurate that is as a designation. But for us Benedictines, at least for this particular Benedictine, the exciting thing is that he manages to preserve a dependence on the traditional sources of revelation, the scriptures. Traditional both as a source of theology, but also as a source of personal meditation, personal holiness. And at the same time starts what we would regard as a very modern intellectual appropriation of those sources as well. And that is for me. And that's why, of course, we have him as our patron, leaders in Sant'Anselmo, not just in Sant'Anselmo. And then we use, it's fashionable, of course, to use certain cliches, for example, faith seeking understanding, etc., etc. But the fact that they're cliches doesn't mean that they're not true. And I certainly find that because it's an enormous challenge all the time. As I was saying earlier on, joining the monastery does not bring with it brain death. And St. Benedict speaks, for example, in the Rule, about expansion of the heart. And I think that's a hugely important concept, the heart seen as the whole person, not just an emotional thing, but also an intellectual thing. That if we think in terms of an expanding context all the time, we've got an expanding context of inquiry, an expanding context of love, and an expanding context of prayer. All these things are contained in that, and that is what I would see. Now, it's possible that I may be reading into St. Anselm. We always tend to interpret people in the light of our own exigencies. But I think at the same time, it's true that he can be taken as a model for these things. I think we sometimes today fall into the trap of thinking that saints must necessarily be nice people. Remember again, of course, one is a saint because of the triumph of grace in one, not because of one's own activities or one's own personality necessarily. So for that reason, when you were asking earlier on there about how you can have a savvy politician and a monk and contemplative at the same time, there may be certain presenting contradictions, but at the same time, if you make allowance for the operation, for the economy of grace in each individual, it's possible to combine these things. I don't know whether St. Anselm was a nice person. He certainly seems to be a holy person.
And warm thanks there go to Benedictine, Dom Henry O'Shea, currently Secretary General to the Abbot Primate of the Benedictine Confederation, and who's originally from the monastery of Glenstall Abbey in Ireland. Hoping to welcome him back to our studios here very soon. Meanwhile, changing the subject, here in the Vatican, a special summer night is filled with wonder, as the Vatican museums remain open from 7 p.m. to 11 p.m. To find out more about this initiative, I called on the director of the Vatican Museums, Professor Antonio Paolucci. I spoke to him across a desk the size of a grand piano, covered in glossy, arty publications. Professor Paolucci, the 24th of July 2009 will go down in history as the first time the Vatican Museums opened to the public at night. What is the purpose of this initiative?
First of all, I wish to introduce myself. I am the director of the Vatican Museum. The benevolence of the Holy Father has appointed me this responsibility, a very great responsibility, as you can understand very well, because the famous masterpieces collected by our Catholic Church through many, many centuries require continuous devotion, need many important resources in order to be enjoyed by all the world. But this one is the problem. Vatican museums must be enjoyed by all the world, by tourists, by the guests coming from far countries, and in a special way, I think, must be enjoyed by the citizen of Rome, by the Roman people. This is the reason I wanted to open the Vatican Museums, the museums of the Pope, at night, the first time in the history of the Vatican Museums.
You just mentioned that you wanted this museum that was opened by the popes as a pop museum. I heard you say that. You called it a pop museum. What did you mean by this?
You must understand that the Vatican Museums are visited each year by 4-5 million people. This is a number terrible, no? This means the Vatican Museums are popular museums, like Uffizi in Florence, like Louvre in Paris. This reality, popular reality of the Vatican Museums, is an important and necessary characteristic of this great reality. The Vatican Museums are the most important concentration in the world of art, of history, of culture, of faith. It's necessary a whole life for now the Vatican Museums. But the time for the tourists is very, very, very little. This is the most important problem.
If the initiative is successful, will there be a follow-up?
I wish that this idea of opening the Vatican Museum will repeat the next year. This is my wish. I hope that this experience, the next 24, will be unforgettable and magnificent and wonderful for the people. I hope that, and I wish say to people of Rome and to our guests in Rome, may you keep for a long in your hearts a good memory of this splendid, magnificent night.
Any advice to those who are going to visit in terms of what you think is most wonderful in the museums?
I wish that the people in the Vatican Museums the next night visit and enjoy it in the Stanza della Segnatura by Raffaello, and in the Cortile Ottagono, inside the Vatican Museums, in the Colle del Belvedere, there are the most important, the most magnificent masterpieces of the Roman and Greek art. The marble of Laocoonte, the Apollo of Belvedere, under the sky of Rome. This is, I think, an unforgettable experience.
And my thanks there go to the director of the Vatican Museums, Professor Antonio Paolucci, for taking the time to speak to us there. Finally, time to join our popular Latin lover, Carmelite, Father Reginald Foster. If you visit the Roman Forum, they're like ruts on the paving, no? Ruts for which one says those were where the chariots went by. But point of fact, in the Forum, the chariots couldn't go by. They weren't allowed to go by.
Later, but see, earlier, yes. I mean, it was a normal street.
Uh-huh.
And the chariots did go by. And then this was prohibited by law.
So, how do you say? The chariot went by in the old days.
Currus transibant per forum. Currus transibant per forum, qua deinde est vetitum. It was forbidden, and they put blocks on both ends of the forum, and that was the end of it.
In Rome, like they do now in Rome.
Exactly, to keep the traffic out.
Mm.
But some of the old marks there from the wheels are still there.
Mm. So they had traffic control.
Oh, yeah, well, they had to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was so bad.
How do you say traffic control?
Come autos moderatio.
Did they have something like a driving license? Or?
Well, I don't know about no driving license. No, but...
So how would you translate driving license?
You'd say gubernandi facultas.
Mm.
Oh, we have all those terms. That's
what about
easy.
Parking?
Parking, yeah.
The parking lot. How do you say parking?
Parking lot. Oh, we say a statio, autoradarum statio. You know, a place, you know, of automobiles. Autoradarum statio.
It's like a station. I mean, our...
A station.
Radio station is called Stazio Radiofonica.
Okay, well, a statio is really where you put things or where people stood. So that's where the cars stood, is the statio.
Mm. And how would you say...
You can say everything. That's easy.
Underground parking.
Underground parking.
How do you say underground parking?
It's subterra, collocatio subterrea. Collocatio, placing your cars, subterrea.
Well, of course, they didn't do that.
Under the ground. No, but you
could
say
we do that now.
I could write this to anyone in the world, and they would say, collocatio autoradarum subterrea. And they would pick it up right away and put in your car below the ground.
Heartfelt thanks there, as always, to Carmelite Father Reginald Foster. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for listening. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now. And don't forget, we'll be back again at this same time tomorrow.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.